Thanks for the nice introduction and the invitation to be here. I'm honored to, you know, open your seminar season or so. So this is a, as I was saying, as Juan was saying, I've been working on black hole cakes because I'm very fascinated by this extreme phenomena. And what I want to present today is a kind of cross-section of a series of results by us and by others on black hole cakes or black hole recoils in their astrophysical environments. In particular, how to kick them out of their astrophysical host of their galaxies. So this is work done in collaboration with all these people, and I like to highlight the people that I underlined there, which are all undergraduate students that I had the extreme pleasure to work with in the past 2 years or so. So
there is a hockey stick if you want to use it as a pointer on that corner.
Ooh, that's Canadian, I guess, right? This actually feels weird. Okay. All right. So here is the. Sorry, I don't feel comfortable with this. So here is the outline of my talk. I'll first introduce why, what are black hole recoils and why I think are interesting. Then where do they lie in the, how to extract them from the simulations and where are they in physics. And then point three will be about dealing with the astrophysical environments of black holes that receives black hole kicks. And in particular, two phases are important here. The first phase where interaction between black holes and accretion disk can actually suppress or enhance the presence of recoils. And now then the system need to be tracked through post-Newtonian evolutions all the way to merger to actually predict what kicks should be or what kicks are. And if I have time at the end, I want to touch base on another recent idea we had semi-recent, on black hole kicks, which is the prospects of performing direct detection of these events with gravitation wave observations. So black hole recoils. So in one word, a recoil is just momentum conservation applied to black hole mergers. So you have two black holes that are merging into each other, and for whatever reason, there's an asymmetry in the binary. Say one black hole is more massive than the other one, one of them is spinning, the other is not, the two spins are misaligned, or any asymmetry of this kind. So if you don't have a perfect equal mass non-spinning system, the emitted waves will be emitted in some, so they will reflect the asymmetry of the system. So there will be some linear momentum emitted in gravitational waves in some preferential direction. And if you're pushing more linear momentum away from the system somewhere, the center of mass, or if you want the final black hole post-merger, has to recoil in the opposite direction. That's basically everything that one has to say about why kicks are there and stuff. The interesting thing is the magnitudes, how big they are compared to the places black holes live in. So numerical relativity simulation have shown that if you play with non-spinning black holes only, you get kicks that are about 100 or 150 kilometers per second or so. But the real fun comes when you start playing with spinning black hole, and in particular when the spin of the two black holes are largely misaligned. So large deviations from the orientation of the orbital angular momentum of the binary. And in this case, which were dubbed as super kicks or so, these kicks can be as large as 4,000 or 5,000 kilometers per second. Now, this plot shows some results from some, semi-recent numerical relativity simulation as a function of the binary mass ratio. So here is equal mass, here is extreme mass. That's the maximum kick that you get maximizing over the spin direction thing, and you see that they get up to, 5,000 or so kilometers per second. There are a couple of points to note about this that, first of all, in GR, a velocity is a dimensionless number. So kicks scale up and down with the total mass of the system. So if you have a mass, a binary with the same, say, mass ratio, spins, and stuff, whether that binary has one or a billion solar masses, the kick is the same. It's just a fraction of the speed of light. That said, though, the typical astrophysical host where a stellar mass black hole or a supermassive black holes live, it's very different. The other interesting thing to note is that to get this large monster of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 kilometers per second, you need kind of a few things to happen, or at least that's what NR simulations are showing. You need black holes that have kind of the same masses, very high spins, possibly maximally spinning black holes, with large spin misalignments, at least 50 to 90 degrees misaligned, And you also need to be lucky with the orbital phase at merger. So not all the orbital phases will give you a big kick. So one might think that because of all these things, super kicks are actually a rather fine-tuned event that in practice almost never happen. And this is precisely where I want to go with this talk. Are super kicks likely in astrophysical environments or not? So I was saying, so these guys are fast. If you put them in context with typical astrophysical hosts, so in this plot here, there's, so on the y-axis, well, is the magnitude, say a measurement of the total mass of the system, and the typical escape speed on the y-axis, you see, you know, GC globular clusters are down here, escape speed of 10 to 50 or so kilometers per second, and large ellipticals, which are the largest galaxies that we know of, are up there in the corner, and their escape speed is a few thousands of kilometers per second. So a super kick, 5,000, will eject a black hole from any known astrophysical host, basically. So now I was saying they're there for both stellar mass and supermassive black holes. Because of their impact on galaxies, we have some tentative evidence for recoiling supermassive black holes. And I'll actually be mostly talking about supermassive black hole in the rest of the talk. So if kicks are as large as, you know, the escape speed of a galaxy, a supermassive black hole can get ejected out of its own galaxy. And, well, Martin Rees predicted it in 89 or so, well before NR simulation or so. The scenario here is that you have two galaxies that are merging. The two black holes find each other, merge, and the final guy is ejected out of the newly formed galaxies, leaving an empty galaxy behind, if you want. Even if kicks are smaller, say a few hundreds of kilometers per second or so, this may be detectable as off-nuclear quasar. So the black hole is recoiling out of the galaxy, taking some accreting mass, maybe a star cluster or so with it, and that blob is visible as a, you know, off-nuclear source in the galaxy. And here, what I have here is actually the most promising candidate from this point of view. So this is an observation over a baseline of, you know, 60 years by now, it's going on. And which was initially thought to be a supernova remnant, but for the fact that it's lasting for 60 years, and a leading candidate to explain this, actually this observation, is that, you know, there was a black hole here some 10 to 50 mega years ago, a black hole merger here, and the final product is recoiling out of this galaxy. So we have a few electromagnetic candidates, but so far, no unambiguous detection, because the signatures and the spectral signatures of all of these are actually very complicated. So one point that I'll touch base at the end is, can gravitational waves help and probe the occurrence of super kicks, of large kicks, say, in nature? All right, so how to model black hole kicks given, you know, evolutions in general relativity of the Einstein's equation? So the kicks are all contained in the waveform. So one point, oh, by the way, this is my scary slide with all the equations, and that's, I won't have any more, almost any more. So first of all, where does the kick come from? And one needs to be careful with coordinates. One might be tempted to, you know, extract the motion of the center of mass from a numerical simulation and claim that that's the motion of the actual black hole. But no, coordinates are a very gauge-y thing in general relativity, and one should not use them. What you really do is to extract the linear momentum flux at infinity, at very large separation. And if you have a linear momentum flux, that has to be interpreted as, so minus the linear momentum flux is the motion of the center of mass of the whole system. So by one can decompose the usual, you know, gravitational wave strain into spherical harmonics. And in terms of this HLM, the flux of linear momentum is just given by this mass equation, which they're not that important. The only thing is that they depend on the derivative of the strain. So the fluxes, the dp here, are mainly due to two things in this equation. So first of all, you have all terms coming in at L minus 1 or so. So these are beatings between different modes at different L and M, that they beat with each other with some coefficients and generate linear momentum. There's also another effect, which is actually the one responsible for the big kicks or super kicks, which are asymmetries between the 2-2 and 2-2 mode. If you neglect whole higher modes, there's a component in the linear momentum flux which actually, you know, follows like this. So if this symmetry here is broken, you actually get net linear momentum flux in some direction. So people have been exploring this thing mostly, I mean, before us, doing fit to numerical relativity simulation. So you do a numerical relativity simulation, they extract the kick, and they fit for this value of the kick as a function of the initial parameter. Now, what we are using is something more sophisticated, and it actually allows us to explore the phenomenology of black hole kicks in a much more, you know, thorough way, which is to exploit numerical relativity surrogate models. So this is something that was not done for kicks. It's done for, you know, LIGO waveform approximants and things. It's basically a very fancy scheme of interpolation where you can obtain the HLM, so the modes, across parameter space just by interpolating numerical relativity simulation. So we've taken these waveform approximants, which include all the modes and, I mean, all up to L equal 4 or 5 or so. So, you know, complete information on black hole kicks, and use them to draw a picture of the phenomenology of kicks across the parameter space. And that's what I want to go through a little bit now.
So, David, just in case there's a misunderstanding, do you really mean sophisticated? Because how could it be sophisticated? I mean, in the sense that you've got the models from the simulation. Here you just interpolate. You have a fancy way to interpolate, but it doesn't have more information than what's already provided by the simulations, because what you're doing is interpolate.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, fancy way of interpolation. That's it turns out that the, you know, the approximant that you get is extremely precise. It's order of magnitude better than any approximant that we had so far. In particular, it encodes information on higher modes and therefore can be used to do kicks physics. So if you don't have spins in the game, you have two non-spinning black hole. You have two limits. So if the black hole, in an equal mass limit, the kick is zero because of symmetry, because there's nothing, no asymmetry in the binary that can provide, that can dissipate, that can beam the gravitational wave somewhere. And also in the extreme mass ratio limit, you have a big black hole and a particle plunging in and there's no kick. So the maximum lies somewhere in between at Q equal 0.2 or something. And the physics here is that you got two objects and the small object moves faster around the big one. So there are more waves beamed in front of the small object, and which causes a kick in the orbital plane. So the kick is zero across the along the orbital angular momentum because of symmetry. And this is shown in this plot. So here is a sequence of binaries with Q ranging from, you know, 1/2 for the light line to 1 for the black line for non-spinning binaries. And these are the velocity projected along, well, x and y are two directions in the orbital plane, and z is the direction of the orbital angular momentum. So the linear momentum flux is zero on z, and that's because the symmetry has, you know, parity if you rotate it up and down. And what's happening is that this guy is the center of mass is oscillating in x and y, and then at some point it receives a kick, like, you know, here, at t of about 5 or 10 close to merger or shortly after merger. So here is an animation of the same thing. This is the motion of the center of mass of the system as extracted from gravitational waves that's oscillating in the orbital plane. The merger happens at this point where the dot is. Then there's the last half of a cycle, and then the final black hole, post-merger black hole at this point, you know, kicks off in this direction.
So you said the merger happens at that point. How do you define the merger?
Oh, that's defined as the total waveform amplitude. So it's the sum of the square of the modes. What?
You define it at the peak of the amplitude.
Yeah, as defined as the peak of the sum of the modes squared. You don't really know where it went. All right, so if you have spins, the key new player in the game is frame dragging. Because so if in particular, if you have two spins which are merging with spins, you know, anti-parallel with each other and into the orbital plane, the frame dragging of each of the two spins acts constructively. And that's the super kick effect, if you want. So what is happening, again, look at this plot here. There's nothing going on in the orbital plane in this case. And all of the kick is along the z direction. So the center of mass is oscillating, see this inset, up and down, up and down. But then at some point, the merger happens. So if the orbital phase is right, and this oscillation is halted at the point where the velocity is large, the thing keeps on going. If the orbital phase is the wrong one, the binary, you know, oscillates, but then it stops when it's at zero velocity and the kick is zero. And you see this. Virtually all the kick is in this last oscillation, super close, I mean, very close to merger, and it reaches value of 1% of the speed of light. or so. So in the movie here, there's an even more complicated case where you have both a mass ratio and spin, so both these mass kick and the spin kick play together, and the result is a rather complicated motion of, you know, this is similar to before, the thing is oscillating because of the mass kick, there's some complicated, you know, orientation of the orbital plane, the merger happens here, and this is the last oscillation of this super kick effect that is, you know, bouncing the black hole off at a speed of more than 1,000 kilometers per second for this particular case.
So if we compare the total rotational velocity, rotational energy of the black holes, the sum of the two, so it's decreasing after this
total, say it again, so the total rotational energy
of the two black holes, so both of them are spinning, right?
Yeah.
So after
I don't know.
Increase.
I don't know. I never did this calculation actually. Maybe somebody knows.
So I
guess it is, but I actually don't know.
I see. So I just wonder whether it's kind of converting rotational energy to kinetic energy. Can we think in that way?
No. So most of what you write here is binding energy. The asymmetry of the system is just letting you write in an asymmetric manner. And then, as you say, once you turn it off, you have sent the net in the amount of radiation in a particular direction. So then, the after burn it off, it compensates moving in the opposite direction. But it's not, the individual objects are not, especially in the equal mass case, the final black hole angular momentum is made up by and large by the orbital contribution. If in the mass ratio case, yeah, that's in the individual ones. But most of the kind of angular momentum budget of the final black hole is provided by the orbital angular momentum.
I see. Then in that case, why high spin is a condition is required?
High spin is because that maximizes a little piece that he has at the end, so maybe.
Yeah. What he was saying is true. So the final spin is, so you should, the final angular momentum is, you know, the sum of the two spins and the orbital angular momentum before plunge, and that's that orbital angular momentum part dominates the final orbital angular momentum budget. If you have spins, this frame dragging thing pushes the center of mass of the system. At least that's the way I understand this. And the more spin you have, the more of this, you know, very last oscillation when the two black holes are very close gets amplified.
The spin of the black hole, just imagine a Schwarzschild black hole, it's innermost thermocircle orbit, it's like 6m. Now, with this maximum spin, it goes down to m. So, a high spinning black hole, two high spinning black holes coming together, merge later. What some people like to call hung up effect, but I hate that terminology. It just says you're going to merge at a much higher frequency. Because you merge at a much higher frequency, you're generating much more gravitational waves. So it's not that the spin is related, it's important for anything particular with the kick, except for the fact that it delays the merger to a moment where the frequency is much higher and the result of the gravitational wave. The total energy you're emitting in gravitational waves is much higher, and the impact on the final black hole is higher.
This is more evident if you look at radiated energy rather than radiated linear momentum, but it's still true here. Okay, here are some more results of this, you know, new way of extracting kicks. So the shape of this profile, in this thing here before, this is the kick is the final direction. So here I'm projecting the whole profile over the final direction of the kick, because it's what defines an intrinsic direction in the system. This curve seems very easy. It's all like, looks like an the integral of a Gaussian or so. So we wanted to, you know, figure out, is this a generic feature or it's not? Well, so what's the shape of the kick, if you want? How is the linear momentum radiated during the evolution of the binary? So in this plot here, I have the same kick, so same binary, actually one of the cases that you saw in the movie before, but projected along random direction. And as you see, the shape widely changes, and in particular, you know, it can be up or down depending on where you're looking the binary from. However, there's a simpler trend that emerges, which is the big kicks are simple. In this plot here, I have random binaries projected on a random direction, and I'm normalizing the kick to one because I want to highlight the shape. And the color is this, the magnitude of the kick. And so the key point here is that the light curves, which are the ones with the big kick, are rather simple. They are simple air function or integral of Gaussians like this, while the small kick are actually more complicated because they have to do many oscillations before it cancels. So overall, the kick shape seems to be rather complicated, but big kicks are simple, which is a simpler trend that emerges out of this study. So how do we compare with other studies and realistic astrophysical environments? So here I picked a distribution which is rather generic, is not meant to be astrophysically meaningful, so uniform mass ratio, uniform spins and stuff. And the distribution of kicks that I obtain is the blue one, and this is compared with previous results, which are the red curves here. And well, compared to other studies, we kind of underpredict, or they overpredict, the fraction and very large kicks, but overall the shape are consistent. And so given this picture here, let's try and have a look at where typical astrophysical systems are. So globular clusters, escape speed of 10 or so kilometers per second, are basically here. So virtually every black hole will get kicked out of a globular cluster. And this is important for people doing LIGO population or so, that it's very hard to, even if you have two black holes merging inside the globular cluster, it's extremely unlikely that the final merger product will be retained in the cluster and available for a second merger.
So you're drawing the spins, you say uniform volumes, so the two are not correlated when you draw them?
They're not. Well, I'll go, I have a whole half of the talk on this, on correlations between the two. Oh, that's just an histogram. Or it's just some normalization of the histogram. No, it's just an histogram with a normalization such that the area is one. So this distribution is not meant to be astrophysically relevant, but just from here you can see that virtually every black hole will have a kick of 10 kilometers per second or so. The Milky Way lies about here. And that really depends on how you pick those numbers there to see if ejection from spiral galaxies like the Milky Way are actually predicted or not. Elliptical galaxies are down here in the tail, so that really boils down to how you populate the tail and things. So all the rest of the talk will be dedicated to astrophysical environments and whether these effects actually happen in realistic astrophysical hosts. So, before I move on, all these things to extract kicks from waveforms and stuff, it's all public. It's a code which I call SirKick. And you can get it just in case you need kicks for whatever you want to do. All right, so are superkicks real in astrophysical environments? And here we need to distinguish two phases, and that's a critical thing. So the argument for superkicks against, if you want, superkicks in galaxies and following supermassive black hole mergers is the following. So, we have numerical relativity simulations. They predict the occurrence of these very large kicks. But at the same time, we kind of don't see empty galaxies. So all the galaxies we looked into, they seem to host a supermassive black hole at their center. We also know that galaxies merge. So if two galaxies are merging, but then we don't see empty galaxies, well, what's going on? Are superkicks there or not? Maybe not. And the standard solution to the problem that was explored since decades is to align the spin. So if spins are preferentially aligned, kicks can get much smaller, and you don't have these large misalignment configuration that are causing super kicks. So the problem of addressing whether super kicks really happen boils down to a model, to have concrete models to align the spin before mergers. So, and to study spin alignment, what really needs to distinguish between two phases. First, you got the astrophysics at large separation, and then relativity kicks in at some point. So, so to understand this, let's do a step back and ask, can black holes really make it? So does that make sense that black holes merge in the first place? So if you take the standard Peters and Matthews equation for the evolution of the separation A and the eccentricity E, there are, two things that you can take out of this almost immediately. If you do the ADE, you find that the eccentricity goes down faster, so this number is less than one, than the separation. So if the separation changes by an order of magnitude, the eccentricity changes by more than that. So if binary, if supermassive black holes have to go down from a parsec to a milliparsec or so, they're basically circular by the time they merge. The other thing one can do is to take A dTdA, and that number gives you a typical timescale on which gravitational wave can dissipate energy and angular momentum and drive a merger. Now, interestingly, this guy scales as A to the fourth, so it's very steep power. One can reverse the same argument by computing the time, the separation, AGW, at which this in spiral timescale is equal to an Hubble time, so the entire life of the universe, and one finds that this, for a supermassive black hole, this separation is about a milliparsec or 0.01 parsec or something like this. So if, you know, galaxies will typically leave you at a separation of tens of parsecs or so, but if you don't get down to this separation, gravitational waves will take forever to produce a single merger. So it's really an interplay. You need some astrophysical phenomenon at large separation, which can dissipate angular momentum faster than gravity. Once this critical separation is reached, because of this steep power, gravitational waves quickly become a very efficient way of dissipating angular momentum and will quickly bring you to a merger. So it's really an interplay between astrophysics at large separation and relativity at small separation. And one needs to track both things to study spin alignment and the occurrence of kicks. So all the rest of the talk is dedicated to gas-rich galaxies, so and how gas disks can align kicks and stuff. But I want to point out in one slide what can happen for gas-poor galaxies. This is a recent, no, not so recent, but a result we had a few years ago with Alberto Cesana, where we basically played this game. Let's look at the biggest galaxies in the universe. So these are BCGs, so brightest cluster galaxies. These are these galaxies like here, which sit at the center of clusters. They're the biggest known systems of, you know, 10 to the 12 solar masses in visible mass and hosting black holes of up to 10 to the 10 solar masses. Now, one might think that these are the worst system ever to look for kicks because their escape speed is very high, so it's very hard to eject stuff from big things. On the other hand, they're so big, they sit at the center of the cluster, that they merge a lot. So they typically grow of a factor 2 to 4 in mass at recent times, so since Z equal 1, which means up to 4 major mergers. So there are many occasions in which a new galaxy is brought in from the rest of the galaxy cluster and a new opportunity to kick out a black hole. And so this is in one plot the results of this study. We build up a merger tree to study these things. And so if you populate the galaxies with black holes at Z equal 1, so here I'm assuming that all galaxies are full at Z equal 1, and you let the merger tree evolve, what you see is that, well, first of all, the fraction of binaries, okay, then I take my sample at Z equals 0 here, and I split it into two, green and red. Now I'll say what they are. But first thing to note is that the sum of these is not 1, meaning that we do find some BCGs with no black holes, because it's been ejected by a kick. The sample at Z equals 0 is split into two. The green one is the one, which is the vast majority, where, you know, nothing that interesting happened. Each black hole, each galaxy brings in a black hole. The black hole merges, stays inside, and you know, the black hole and the galaxy grow together. Red sample instead, these are the replenished galaxies. So there's a merger, a black hole gets kicked out, but then a new black hole is brought in by another small galaxy in the cluster, and a possible signature is that they lie below the expected bulge black hole correlation law. And we estimated that with order of, right now there are like 3 or 4 black hole measured in BCGs, and we estimated that with like hundreds, you can do kick physics with it.
But here, when you do this study, you've assumed that the encounter could have any speed. You have field address.
Yes.
So it could have been any alignment.
Yes, because I mean these are gas-poor galaxies, so you think that there's nothing that correlates the spin direction. Now all the rest of my talk is on gas-rich galaxies, where gas-driven spin alignment becomes absolutely crucial. So the key physical phenomenon here is the so-called Bardeen-Patterson effect. So if you have a black hole surrounded by an accretion disk, which is misaligned, so look at the outer part of the disk, misaligned by some angle phi or so, What's happening is that you got lens steering precession because of the frame dragging on the spinning black hole that dissipates angular momentum in the inner disk. So the inner disk quickly aligns up to a certain radius, and that radius is where the lens steering precession equals the viscous timescale of the disk. So lens steering precession cannot, the disk cannot adjust itself to the you know, perturbation of the black hole. And by doing that, by equating these two timescales, this thing scales as, you know, this expression here, where crucially alpha 2 is a coefficient that sets the vertical viscosity in the disk, not the horizontal one, not the usual alpha of the Shakura-Sunyaev disks. So point 2, by reaction, the outer disk, which is typically more massive, by Newton's third law, acts, reacts onto the black hole and pulls the black hole towards an alignment with the outer disk. And this phenomenon happened on a timescale which is, you know, stated here. Crucially, again, alpha is the horizontal viscosity of the disk, the usual, you know, viscous terms, and alpha 2 is the vertical, is the warp propagation or the vertical viscosity, and h over r is the thickness of the disk. Now, if you have infinite time available, all black holes will align with its own disk. Now, the problem is that in a binary system, you don't have...
assumption that the disk is more massive than the black hole?
Yeah, but that's typically, that in an AGN disk, it's typically the case. So if you don't have infinite time, and in a binary you don't, because at some point these things are aligning, but at some point the merger happens, or better, at some point gravitational waves will take over, and all this disk physics stops. So is there enough time to align the spin or not? So what you really do here is to compare timescales. And so, okay, the typical phenomenology of two black holes accreting, you know, embedded in an AGN disk or so, can be roughly divided as follows. So if you have extreme mass ratios, so one black hole is much smaller than the other, you got a circumbinary disk, a big black hole sitting in the center, and a secondary black hole which perturbs the disk and opens a gap into the circumbinary disk. This is the so-called planetary regime, because it's the same thing that people do in protoplanet study. You know, they have forming planets in protoplanetary disks around stars. So it's basically the same physics. If you have higher Q, so the two black holes have kind of the same mass, the binary now carves a cavity into the disk, and there are gas streams feeding into this mini disk, or, you know, circum black hole disk, if you want, that, you know, accrete onto the small disk and then onto the black hole. So the crucial thing to notice is that while the in spiral, so we want to compare alignment and in spiral, and the in spiral is set by the properties of the circumbinary disk, while alignment is set by the properties of these two individual disks. And so
the charges of the latter are much more on the former, right?
So it's almost, for supermassive black hole, we are here. We are likely.
When you have galaxy mergers, people have estimated that the typical mass ratio would be 10, 30 to 1. Are you not closer to that one as opposed to this one?
Isn't it 0.3? So 1 to 3, the typical. I think, you know, in Marta Volontari's simulations or so, the spectrum of the mass ratio peaks at about a third. But it's broad, and we don't really know. That depends on how seeds. The seed formation and all this.
Well, we use whatever name sigma relation and we look at the galaxies out there. So what's Andromeda's mass with respect to our mass?
2 to 1.
That's 2 to 1. Okay.
But you're right that there's a whole spectrum of mergers, and so if the black hole is facing those, I mean, there should be a spectrum. But is the idea though that for, like, you know, mass ratio that are very extreme, you know, so the idea that the smaller black hole, you know, I mean, oh, right, you're using that little friction to bring them together, I guess, right?
Well, I'm not really. I'm actually, well, just give me a second because it's in here. So, okay, so the black holes are coming together because of different phenomena. So there will be some dynamical friction and large separation, and then eventually viscous drag by the circumbinary disk at smaller separation. That's related to the final parsec problem. You actually bring stuff to the last parsec. And here I'm assuming that that's solved, in a sense that I'm only tracking things during the disk phase of the evolution, with the idea that even if the final parsec problem is solved, it's probably So viscous accretion is probably the bottleneck of the whole evolution. So it's the slower evolution, it's the slower timescale in the process. And so the in spiral timescale here roughly scales as the viscous timescale of the disk that sets the overall units or so. This term here accounts for the fact of this gap opening thing. And that's the same, these are planet people, the same thing that they use for planetary dynamics. And so this term here partially accounts for some of these phenomena, and it has an announcement because of a massive companion. So what we are set to do now is to compare this thing against the alignment timescales.
And the simulations you're showing here, these were for planet systems.
No, these are black hole simulations.
The disk is more massive than the black hole.
Yes, these are black hole simulations.
So why do they know that this is like Chomrey stable? I don't understand.
I think the disk has the size of the disk is where Q is equal to 1. I think they set the size of the disk to prevent fragmentation.
Like there's a thin disk which dominates the gravity, right?
They don't have.
That should be unstable, right?
Not really. I mean, yeah, but here in this simulation, I don't think there's even back reaction of the disk onto the black hole. So it's a black hole in a fixed orbit, and they study the accretion.
But the back reaction of the disk on itself, I'm saying, should drive it stable.
I don't know. I think it's the disk is smaller.
For like planetary system, just like the central star stabilizing the disk. Here you have this.
I don't know. I never done this simulation by myself. We are fitting results by other. What I understand is that the disk is small enough that it's not Chomrey unstable in this simulation.
There's no viscosity in this simulation.
I don't think so. No, I don't.
You're
think
not very close.
So here, what we really want to do is to look at the spin alignment process, and we use these simulations and stuff to fit for the what mass really, so how is the dynamics, so the accretion, because you got the circumbinary disk that sets the alignment, the in spiral process, then you have some mass that overcomes this cavity pileup and gets into the mini disk. So you need some prescriptions to split the mass, the accretion rate into what goes into the primary, what goes into the secondary, what piles up at the inner edge of the cavity, and that's what we are using these simulations for. And so in a single slide, the results from this rough timescale comparison are in this figure. So here we show there are three timescales on the y-axis. The dashed line is the in spiral timescale, as given in the slide before, and the two color bands are the alignment timescale of either of the two black holes, the secondary, so the small black hole in green, and the big black hole in red. And so the key point is that the alignment of the secondary is faster than that of the primary, and the reason here is that the secondary black hole orbits much closer to the edge of the cavity, so it's sweeps the edge of the cavity and accretes more than the secondary. And so it's more mass and stuff, so it aligns faster. Crucially, at some critical mass ratio of about 0.2 or 0.3, the alignment timescale of the primary can get smaller than the in spiral timescale. So while secondaries always align, primaries do not, assume if the mass ratio is big enough. Up here, small enough, sorry, well, is extreme enough, let's say, up there. And the reason is that the secondary eats so much that basically the primary starves. There's not much mass coming in onto the primary, and so the alignment is slowed down sensibly. So because of this differential accretion, which of the two accretes more, we predict the occurrence of, therefore, a sufficiently extreme mass ratio, about 0.2 or so, secondaries may be aligned, but primaries might be not. And the key point is that small secondaries might prevent primaries from aligning.
So this alignment, so if you start with a misaligned case, do you need to accrete like mass comparable to the black hole mass to align it? Like how much mass?
No, it's less because the lever arm is larger. So if you accrete a mass comparable to the black hole mass, you spin up the black hole sensibly. But because of this, of the Bardeen-Patterson effect, so this picture here, the lever arm, the warp radius, so RBP or so, it's much larger than the than the gravitational radius of the black hole. So you're like accreting from the lever arm is larger, so you need less mass to tilt the orbital angular momentum because you're tilting it from up here.
So is this alignment happening just through accretion, or is there some effect from like the torque on the disk?
We are neglecting it. So the real effect is the torque from the companion. So you have a black hole, a disk, but this black hole and mini disk is orbiting a companion, and that companion will exert the torque. So we estimated that this is a factor of a few in the alignment timescale, but one should be more careful with this. There's a torque from the companion, though, yeah.
Interesting, you may have discussed this already. The present available data, like over says the measured effective spin of the 6 minutes, is clustered around zero, except for 1 minute. So there are two interpretations. It's the initial measuring black holes have a small spin, or they're misaligned. So the LIGO people prefer the small spin. So that's what we know at present.
I don't think the LIGO people prefer anything. I think the LIGO people don't prefer either way.
I've talked to them. In fact, people can.
These are supermassive black holes, so yeah, these are not really LIGO sources.
We don't know anything about supermassive. We're waiting for event horizon telescope.
Or LISA, yeah. I mean, we do have some measurements of spins in supermassive black holes through iron lines, but they seem to show big spins, but there's a selection bias, and I don't want to go. So at some point, so even if disk physics will leave you with a misaligned primary and an aligned secondary or so, at some point, disk physics is not important anymore, and what you really should do is to track spin-spin and spin-orbit coupling and evolve these things in general relativity, or better, in some post-Newtonian approximation. So this happens when in spiral rate through gravitational waves is equal to the in spiral timescale, which is the so-called decoupling radius, and it's about thousands or so of gravitational radii of the binary, and at that point the disk basically cannot keep up with the binary, so the binary evolution proceeds because of gravitational wave emission, and the disk is frozen or decouples from the binary evolution. So what one really needs to do is to track spin-spin and spin-orbit couplings. And of course, this whole business is important for gravitational wave observation and stuff. The idea is that if the spins align, you would expect a waveform that looks like this. If the spins are misaligned, the orbital plane is precessing, so you have a kind of lighthouse effect because gravitational waves are beamed along the orbital plane, along the direction of the orbital angular momentum. So if this orbital plane is wobbling, you see this precession, you should see these precession modulations or so. So the key question I want to answer is not really going into precession, spin precession, but what's the effect on black hole kicks on all of these, because that's what we want to do here. So let me first define a couple of angles or so. So if you put the orbital angular momentum L along, say, the z-axis, let me call theta 1 and theta 2 the angle between S1, the two spins, S1 and S2, where 1 means big black hole, 2 means small black hole. And let me call delta phi being the angle between the projection of the two spins onto the orbital plane. So take the two spins down onto the orbital plane, and that's the relative angle between the two. And that's a kind of precession phase. These two things are precessing, and that measures somehow the precessional phase. Instead of showing any post-Newtonian dynamics, I'll show an example, which in my opinion illustrates really the key point here. So this is just an exercise where I've taken an isotropic distribution of black hole binaries. So at the initial separation, that's set to a 10 to the 4 m or something. The sample is isotropic, so it's a grid in the two spin tilts, theta 1, theta 2, and it's uniform in delta phi. Up there. So then I let this sample of binaries evolve, and I track them all the way down to 10m, so very close to merger or where the PN approximation breaks down or so. And as you see, nothing kind of seems to happen in a sense that you have an isotropic distribution before, which stays pretty isotropic at the end. And this result is known since 27 at least or so. Now, Here I show the same evolution. This is exactly the same figure, but with colors. Now, here I'm coloring in red and blue, you know, points that are above and below the bisector in the initial condition. So blue points are the ones for which the secondary is more aligned than the primary, and red points are the ones for which the primary is more aligned than the secondary. So if you look in the... with the orbital angular momentum. Yes. So if you look in these spin tilts, so these are the angle between the two spins and the orbital angular momentum, things remain more or less isotropic. They remain isotropic all the way to the end. The interesting part happens in this variable delta phi here. As you evolve down, you see the red points tend to cluster here at about delta phi equals zero, and blue points tend to cluster here at about delta phi equal pi. Now, delta phi, that was the projection of the two spins onto the orbital plane, you can, you know, one can immediately see is that it's going to be crucial for kicks, because the more, if that's close to pi, that's where the super kick configuration is, with the frame dragging, the oscillation, and all the rest. And if it's close to zero, kicks are going to be more suppressed. So disk physics, or if you want the astrophysics, will tell you where in the parameter space you are in these spin tilts. But post-Newtonian evolution will cluster the binaries in some region with some values of delta phi that then are responsible for kicks. And I hope you see this interplay between astrophysics and relativity here. So here is a plot showing kind of this idea. So these are preliminary results by my undergraduate student, Luca Reali. And basically we have, so something I don't have time to go through, but we have a proper way to distinguish what does it mean to be close to delta phi equals zero or pi. You can actually classify the spin precession solutions into what we call morphologies. And this is a consequence of kicks. So basically, for a given sample of binary, that's not really, you know, important or astrophysically relevant in this figure. But if you take all the binaries, that's a red curve, all the binaries which are close to delta phi equal pi are red, and the binaries which are close to delta phi equal zero are blue. And what we are plotting here is the actual final value of the kick. And as you see here, I mean, all big kicks are red. So only one of the three spin morphology will actually be produced large kicks. So it's crucial to predict where the how are these three going to populate in an actual astrophysical environment. And so in this plot, I try to put everything together. So what I'm doing here is the following. So I take a sample of black holes with Q equal 0.2. That's at the threshold where primary starts being misaligned. And I assume an isotropic, well, what I'm doing here is I really, you know, I place the binary in this plot according to their value of cosine of the tilt angles at the decoupling. So assume the disk physics will give me a binary which is here or there. And then I color the points according to the final kick. Does that make sense? So the binaries won't be here at merger because it oscillates around because of this spin precession business, but I'm leaving the point where it is at the coupling and then plotting the final value of the kick. And the immediate thing that one notices is that big kicks are up there. And well, up there is where the secondary is. Cosine of theta 2 is 1, so the secondary is aligned, and the primary is somewhat misaligned, which is exactly the region of the parameter space that we predicted should be more populated following our disk physics argument. So if all of this is true, maybe larger coils in gas-rich galaxies are more common than we thought, and surely more work is needed here. Okay, so I want to go for, you know, five or so, the last 5 or 10 minutes, into another idea, switching gears a little bit, on performing direct detection of super kicks with gravitational wave observation. So in a gravitational wave observation, the mass and the redshift are really degenerate. So through the phase of the waves, and that's the case for cosmology, for instance, through the phase of the waves, one does not really measure the mass of the system, but the redshifted mass, mass times 1 plus z. And that's because there's no scale, I mean, there's no set scale in GR or so. So in the case of the cosmological redshift, though, that's a true degeneracy in the sense that, you know, this redshift, the entire signal from the Erlang spiral to the late ringdown is redshifted. So you cannot really tell them apart through the phase of the wave alone. So if you have a kick, the center of mass is recoiling, So that's also kind of redshift. So one does not really measure the mass of the kick, the mass of the binary, but rather the mass times the velocity projected along the line of sight. Now, crucially, there's a t dependence here, meaning that that's not, in principle at least, it's not a true degeneracy, because only the final part of the signal are redshifted, not the earliest part. So here is this effect, you know, shown in a pictorial way in a highly exaggerated case where the kick is half the speed of light, recoiling away from you, so the binary is redshifted, or recoiling towards you. And the key point here is that nothing happens in the early, you know, in spiral, and all the blue shift or redshift happens in the late, in the merger and ring down part. Now, this kick is huge, and in terms of, you know, V over C, an actual astrophysical kick, even if it's a super kick, is still small. It's still, you know, at most a 1% effect. So we can do a back of the envelope calculation to see if this thing could be detectable or not. And one, what one can do is to take, you know, the gravitation wave strain and imagine to break it down into two parts, an in spiral part and a ring down part, that you, you know, cut it and merger or so. So the mass that you measure from the ring down should be roughly the mass that you measure from the in spiral times the kick. Now, assuming there are no errors in the mass from the in spiral, if you want to measure this term here, which is roughly for a super kick is a 1% effect. So even for a super kick, you need to measure, you need to be able to measure the mass from the ring down part of the signal at 1%. Which means roughly a signal to noise ratio in the ring down part of the signal only of about 100, which is a lot, in a sense that even 15 or 914, there was a loud source, it had an SNR, a ring down SNR or of 4 or 5, depending where you start. So this is gonna be tough, if not impossible, I would say, for LIGO, but third generation detectors, so future ground-based interferometers, and LISA, the space mission, can actually make it. And here is a plot showing this, you know, quantifying this claim a little bit more carefully. So what one can do is to take a standard waveform, so take a binary, you know, waveform, a signal detectable by LIGO or so, and you kick it. So you add a kick by stretching the time axis in the right way to implement a Doppler shift. One can compute the signal to noise ratio and the so-called overlap, which is basically a measurement of how similar the two waveforms are. If the overlap is small enough for a given SNR, that's a rough criterion to claim a distinguishability of the effect that you put into the wave. So if you plot system in the overlap signal to noise ratio plot, only the system which are above this black line will have a kick effect which is strong enough to be detectable. And that fraction for a typical LIGO population is zero, but some LISA sources might have kicks which are strong enough to be detected, or better, LISA would be so precise that even tiny effects like kicks could possibly be seen.
So how are you calculating the standard gravitational wave?
It's just a standard approximant.
So you're just taking something?
Whatever, this was done with the phenom P approximant.
And you just take the term, it's the kick term, and set it to zero?
Yeah, it's actually very easy. So you just take H of T from whatever approximant, and you have a V of T profile, and you stretch the time axis accordingly.
I mean, before you were talking about the ring down mass, the spiral mass, or something. But I mean, to connect those two.
Yeah, that was a, you know, back of the envelope argument. Here, what we are really doing is that. So suppose you have the waveform here. Over, you know, time, and you have a V of T profile, you know, V of T, say one of these curves that I was showing in the beginning. You need to, you know, take this time axis and stretch it accordingly, so T goes to T plus V of T. Where this is the integral of V, or something like this.
So you are claiming that we need third generation detectors to see this kick.
Yeah.
I remember roughly there was a paper by David Shoemaker.
Yes, and it's here. So after we put out these studies, I want to, you know, point out a couple of developments of this. So the first one, which is what Juan is mentioning, I was not really involved in this paper. So if you remember my scary slide at the beginning, I was saying the kicks comes in with beatings between higher order modes. So these folks here, they basically showed that detection of higher modes, which therefore encodes the kick and all the rest, might be much easier to detect than our Doppler shift. In particular, claiming that kicks might be observable at an SNR as low as 15 for the right sources. Now, the question remains on whether, you know, if you see higher order modes, are you really seeing the kick, or you're seeing higher order modes, or so? That's more a semantic issue, I think. The other very recent work that I was involved with, and this is actually appearing tonight on the archive. I didn't time it. This is, you know, Katie. So Katie Chamberlain, she's an undergraduate that worked with me on a summer project at Caltech last summer and is now starting a PhD in Arizona. We basically did this calculation of, you know, not necessarily through kicks, but to how to implement Doppler shift in any way from approximants. And so the easy way to do it is to do it in the time domain, like I was sketching here. And we computed correction into the frequency domain waveform that you should compute, achieving, you know, very high precision. In overall this cycle, you know, the black one is the non-Doppler shifted waveform, and the blue and the red that you don't even see are the time domain and the frequency domain Doppler shifted thing, and they're basically identical. So this provides a nice, quick and easy to use and easy to implement prescription to add a Doppler shift into any pre-existing waveform approximant. And then that's not just useful for kicks, but also for, you know, tertiary companions. Suppose your binary is falling in the gravitational potential of a third guy that will cause a proper acceleration, so a Doppler shift onto the signal. This is a, you know, straightforward implementation for any given V of T profile to put it into the waveform. So I'll conclude with this, you know, summary slide on this last part, that you know, a measurement of a black hole kick through gravitational waves would actually be of fundamental interest, in a sense that much like the Hals-Taylor pulsar provided the first evidence that gravitational waves are carrying energy and angular momentum, the first event provided direct evidence of the gravitational waves. A direct measurement of a black hole kick would be the first measurement that gravitational waves actually carry linear momentum, which kind of has to be there, but, you know. All right, and this is my last slide. So I hope I convinced you that black hole recoils are interesting and a cool, you know, phenomenon to study. I showed a bit how to extract recoils from waveforms and how you can exploit surrogate models to do this task. I then went a little bit into some details on why on whether super kicks are real in realistic astrophysical environments, and one needs to track both the disk physics at the beginning and the post-Newtonian evolution at the end. And finally, I hinted how possibly kicks can be directly detected through gravitational wave observation, and well, stay tuned for a paper appearing today. Okay, thanks.
So if the dark matter is formable black hole, and you have this effect at the center of the galaxies, will this help you maybe solve the Korpas problem?
I don't know.
Or so it's the effect if you estimate kind.
I don't know. Sorry.
Like for the masses, I guess that you're thinking about, but I think that the dark matter is a collision. That's
so the number is so small.
Yeah.
So any estimates on the detection rate of these black hole supermassive black hole mergers?
Supermassive black hole mergers for?
Say we have the potential to detect these kicks.
To detect kicks or
to start with to detect supermassive black holes merging.
Well, we need to wait for LISA. I mean, you need to go to space because you need millions of kilometers of interferometers arm. But the detection rates are tens or hundreds or so, depending on which models actually you believe in. No, overall the duration of the mission. But the duration of a mission is, it's 4 years, 5 years, 10 years maybe. So order factor 10. But.
So if I flip things around, so now with this, suppose we have no evidence. I mean, even doubt on that, you said there's a lot of controversy. No evidence of an off-center quasar. So what would be your first kind of reaction? So let's believe that. So with this, what would you put your your conclusion that somehow black holes are aligned this way, or I want to follow the opposite. I want to say, okay, we have no evidence whatsoever. What is that telling us about the distribution?
I think it will tell us that spins do align. I don't see any other ways of, you know, preventing these things, unless our simulations are wrong. Otherwise, spin has to align somehow, and maybe, you know, disk interaction is stronger than we thought, or, you know, one needs to consider. Yeah. I mean, there's so many uncertainties as in all astrophysical.
But in your model, you have whenever the primary was.
Misaligned.
Misaligned.
Yes.
And the role of the companion. So you were, for some distribution of the companion, you could still accommodate not a big kick.
Yes, that's correct.
So what's the most hopeful kind of scenario that you could see that would still be consistent with no strong kick?
I mean, so two things. Either mass ratios are closer to unity, so that, you know, things align faster. But if they're close to unity, they also suffer from larger kicks. Or spins are not that large. So I mean, in that plot, maybe I don't know if I said it or not, but in this plot here, everything is maximally spinning.
Oh.
Right. So yeah. So everything here is maximally spinning, and it's actually also maximizing over the orbital phase. You also need a lucky orbital phase. Because here I wanted to show where big kicks are in parameter space, but how many big kicks are there? That's a complicated. Yes?
We're awaiting new events, like we're supposed to start off very soon. So if the effective spin circulation continues to be clustered around zero, you either have misalignment or you have small spin.
Mm-hmm.
Have you applied your methods to
for yes, we did. We have, So then, okay. So there you need to go into how black holes form from stars, right? Or whether they form, how they form, and there are, I don't know how many details. We have, we have done spin evolutions and stuff for you know LIGO black holes, and the key point here is. What's the how you populate the spin space from the astrophysics? And things can happen like, you know, if you have a black hole formed in a binary stars, if you have tidal interaction, the spins tend to align. But if you have natal kicks, so kicks, these are not these merger kicks, these are kicks at formation. So as the star collapses and forms a black hole, the new system can get kicked. So you're tilting the orbital plane, which is in turn the tilt of the spin. That will, you know, put you somewhere differently in this plane. Mass transfer can also align the spin and stuff. And you know, we have studied the interplay between this thing, showing that if you can measure this angle delta phi, where these different, you know, zero or pi resonances are, that can actually help you to constrain these astrophysical phenomena like mass transfer, tides, natal kicks, and stuff.
There's a tool.
So what percentage of these galaxy mergers, massive supermassive black hole mergers, do we expect the gas effect to be included?
So say it again. What?
So what percentage of these massive, supermassive black hole mergers do you think?
So we have the only thing that we were able to do is where is it? It's written down here. So 10%, that's the order of magnitude. So here we've taken cosmologically motivated. So this comes from some merger trees. And these were developed for the first LISA mock data challenge. So we took the data out, the catalogs of the mock data challenge, and ran all these alignment business and comparison here, and show that roughly 10% of the primaries might be misaligned.
Yeah, but this is assuming the gas effect is important. There is gas, there's a disk there.
Yeah, it is.
I'm asking what percentage of these binaries have gas there?
Have gas around?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know on the top of my head. Factor.
And also, I was looking at that plot you give, so can you go back to that plot? You're saying that
this one?
This plot. So if there is no gas around, so I would imagine the spins will be totally random in that case.
Yeah, then take the whole plot.
Yeah, the whole plane.
Yeah.
So then if I look at an area that has most red dots, that's almost 1/4 of the total area.
Yes.
So it's like, even if it's random, you can just still have a pretty high chance to get.
Yeah, and that was the idea of this. Of these results I was showing before on gas poor galaxies, where here we don't have any alignment process and stuff, and still find some event that are ejected by even the most massive galaxies. That's exactly why, and you have a chance just by random encounter and stuff, you have a chance to get big kicks.
This is a small percentage in the output.
It is.
You're saying you have 25%. How is it that to this day we have zero evidence, or maybe 0.5 evidence of something that hint?
I think it's, I don't know, here one needs to talk to the observational people here. I think my understanding is that it's very hard to disentangle the signatures of a recoiling black hole from all sorts of other things.
That's my understanding as well.
Yeah.
But imagine if 25% are given something, I would imagine there should be a few clear smoking guns out there.
You said 25% because of the box?
Yeah.
But again, this is all binaries with maximally spinning Q equal 2 and maximizing over the orbital phase as well. So as I was saying, so more work needed here. This is only hinting that disk physics might put more binaries there where you have more chance to be kicked. But then, claiming it's 25 or 0.025%. It's
No, let's send the speaker again.